Ladies and gentlemen, I call this meeting of Fluvana County Board of Supervisors to order. We will begin with the pledge of allegiance, followed by a moment of silence.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you very much. We do not have a quorum of school board members, so we do not have to call a school board meeting to order. Skipped around that one. All right, do we have an adoption of the agenda?
So moved. We adopt the agenda.
All right. Motion's made by Ms. Booker, seconded by Mr. O'Brien. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 4-0, Mr. Weaver being absent. All righty. Folks, I want to welcome all of our elected officials. I see Mr. Bell, Delegate Bell online. I'm not sure if Mr. Goodwin has gotten here yet, but I understand Mr. Peake's got his hands full. And Mr. Delegate Ware, thank you so much for coming in today. I guess the first thing we ought to do is make sure we introduce ourselves, but I think everybody pretty much knows everyone. But Mr. O'Brien, if you get started.
I'm Tony O'Brien. I'm with the Ravenna District for the Board of Supervisors.
Mike Sheridan, Columbia District.
Melissa
Booker,
Clark Union.
Trisha Eager. Major David Wells, I'm filling in for Sheriff Hess, Sheriff's Office.
Tristana Treadway, Clerk of the Circuit Court.
Lee Ware, the 65th District, which is the eastern two-thirds of the county.
Kim May, Director of Social Services.
Brenda Gillum, Executive Director for Instruction and Finance for the schools.
Eric Dahl, County Administrator, and before we go this way, we have some staff here today. Staff, if you just kind of stand up and give a quick introduction as well.
Brian Muller, our Children's Services Office.
Donna Snow, Human Resources Manager. Tori Melton, Family.
Aaron Spitzer, Director of Parks and Rec.
Jennifer Schneider, Economic Development Director.
Douglas Miles, Community Development Director.
And that other gentleman needs to stand up and
Yes, and we have a supervisor-elect here.
Chris Fairchild, supervisor-elect of Cunningham. Thank you.
And then finish up.
Caitlin Solis, Clerk to the Board of Supervisors.
Kelly Harris, Assistant County Administrator.
And then maybe if we want to go through the through the round of squares up on the screen. Delegate Bell, do you want to start off?
I'm the first square together.
Hollywood Square.
Rob Bell, 58th District, western third, but two-thirds of the people. Thank you.
Yeah. David?
Yes, good afternoon. David Blunt, Deputy Director, Director of Legislative Services for TJPDC.
Mel?
Mel Sheridan, Commissioner of the Revenue's Office. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Shirley?
Shirley Stewart, Fluvana School Board for the Ravenna District.
Andy?
Andy Melvin, I'm the Director of IT.
Debbie?
Hi, Debbie Smith. I'm the Emergency Medical Coordinator for Fluvana County.
And I see Dr. Bonds.
Oh, hi, Denise Bonds. I'm the Health Director for the Blue Ridge Health District that includes Fluvana County.
Okay, and I see Jordan Hargrave.
I'm Jordan and I work for Delegate Rob Bell.
Great.
All right. So, Delegate Ware, you're here. You want to go first? It's basically general remarks.
Sure. And do you want me to turn? Is the microphone on? And
it's on.
It is on right now, yes, sir.
I'm used to seeing a light up and then.
It's a little green light on there, I believe.
Okay. Well, obviously, we have just gone through an election statewide, and the results of that election will have a significant effect on where we go, what priorities there are as we go forward in the coming session. A number of us will be sworn in, no small number for the first time. and the majority in the House switches from majority currently Democrat to pending two election recounts, a majority Republican. So that will mean a change of leadership. We come in with an uncommonly strong financial situation. If you've noticed in the newspapers recently, there are varying estimates of what the revenue will be, how much new revenue we can anticipate, but it's somewhere north of $8 billion for the biennium, which is extraordinary. At the same time, we have people who are lining up with their hands out, and so there will be many requests that come to that, and recommendations that came to us, obviously, with that kind of revenue, is to do a number of things that would be one-time expenditures rather than ongoing expenditures in the budget. So that will be one of the things that we consider as we go forward on that score. Then, too, we do have a new governor coming in, and he has his own priorities and agenda, some of which I'm sure have been announced, and some will be as we go forward. So those are some of the things that we anticipate going in. I won't go much into it. Delegate Bell is very much on top of redistricting, but obviously looming in the background for us in the House particularly is the redistricting, which is ongoing, and probably will be, as I say, part of the discussion as we go forward. That's a significant factor for many of us, for all of us, and a lot of unknowns with the redistricting commission, and now with the ball having been kicked to the state Supreme Court and their special masters to draw maps. So we begin in a very different posture than we were when we came together about 12 months ago. I'm looking forward to it, and looking forward to the opportunities in this new circumstance.
All right, thank you very much, sir. Delegate Bell?
I kind of almost would like to not skip this, get right to it, but I would echo most of what Lee said, just that the changes are so profound compared to a year ago, and as much as the Lee and I go from being fairly senior members of the minority to fairly senior members of the majority. But beyond that, of course, when the change of governor is always a big change, but when it's also on top of it a change of the party of the governor, it's multiples of that. And so I think that we are all reviewing what thoughts we had about what we might do, what might not be able to do, what options are available. The governor's team is not yet in place, and so we don't even know who we would be working with in the governor's shop. That'll be officially done in January, but typically over the month of December, they start to make announcements of who will be heading up the policy shop for education, say, or for public safety. Lee also touched on this, that this is the redistricting year. It was going to be last year, but because of the census difficulties, it was put off until this year. But right now, they're in the process, and I'm happy to talk about this further if there's any interest, but they're in the process at the Supreme Court of drawing the map that will apply at our level, and then I know that the localities are also in the midst of doing their own redistricting. So with all that, I look forward to hearing everybody's comments, and thanks for having me back.
Thank you very much. Has anyone joined us from Senator Peake's office? Okay, well, I'm quite certain that redistricting will be brought up today. but thank y'all so much for coming out. Please know how much we appreciate the work that y'all do down in Richmond. And I know it's comforting for me to be able to pick up the phone and call you guys and not talk to a staffer, but to talk to y'all. So thank y'all so much for that. All right, legislative concerns. Let's go ahead and get started.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess if you want to go to page 2 of your green package here. So this was just what we provided to Delegate Bell and Delegate Ware ahead of the meeting today. These were just some of the topics and issues that staff brought up, board members brought up, some constitutional officers in the school. So I guess if you want to kind of start at the top and kind of go down regarding the issues and, have a healthy discussion from that standpoint.
Well, this is one, I ought to be able to remember the first ones. I'm on Education Steering Committee down at VACA, and we just had our convention, and one of the big things that we talked about were the SOQ qualifications that are on. Is there a look going into expanding those right now for the schools? When I say that, the governor brought it up when he spoke to us on Tuesday morning. He goes, man, during my term, we've expanded teacher salaries 10%. And yes, you did. And we are so thankful for all that you guys give us. But y'all were 10% for a third of the salaries. And we're the other two thirds. So is there any thought about expanding that? I know they were talking about expanding the aides numbers especially. Ms. Gillum? How would I, the aides?
Instructional
assistants. I went blank for a second.
That's okay.
So are there any conversations going on into that, or is that a possibility?
I think as Rob indicated at the outset, a lot of these things will be pending what the new administration brings to us. I have not heard from the current administration who brings their final budget to us on mid-December. That they intend to add to that. One thing that I did hear in the conversations, we had the money committees met earlier this week, and right now, of a 1.25 million students Commonwealth-wide, they're estimated to be about 2,000 new students. So with last year's drop of nearly 4% enrollment statewide, it appears to be roughly in the same posture this year. I don't know what Fluban is experiencing. He may be able to give us that.
Ms. Gillum, can you speak to that one?
We've had some decline over the last couple of years, but we're anticipating it starting to tick back up in this next year.
During the course of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's, and of course, as you know, last year we were keen to include a hold harmless provision that would provide SOQ funding for the student level we anticipated, as opposed to what actually appeared at most localities. I suspect that will that part of it will continue, but in terms of additional positions, that I have not seen that conversation. Neither Rob or I serve on the education committees, right. So we don't, some of that conversation we don't get to until the end.
And I know I'm getting the cart before the horse when I talk about these things now, because you won't talk to them, but that's one of our big issues that I have, and we kind of look at it as an unfunded mandate, and I hate to start this in a negative thing, but with the other big one is the sheriff's office. You know, we are so thankful. I believe it was a $3,000 stipend that y'all, a bonus that y'all gave, but it was only for 20 positions in our sheriff's office, and our sheriff's office has 37. So we were left with the fact of, okay, do we say we're not going to give all of them the bonus, or do we come up with bonuses for the other 17, which we did? But, you know, that's my question, or my hope, is that we will look into expanding those numbers.
Sorry, I didn't want to cut you off.
No, go ahead. I'm going to forget sometimes because you're on the screen, Rob.
Okay, and maybe this is going to come up later. Do we know if there's going to be changes to the composite index for Fluban, and if so, do we know what they will be?
Yes, there is a change in the composite index. It's an increase of 0.0087.
0.0087, so not as big as sometimes we have seen.
For us, it's probably going to be around $600,000.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get at, and if you could translate that into money. Okay.
Yeah.
There's neither Lee and I are talking about it as if we sit on appropriations, which we don't. Ultimately, they have traditionally been very careful about forecasting revenues to remain at the same level, meaning we have a sizable lump sum right now, but the assumption that it's going to last is very different. And some of the issues you're describing, like bonuses, are by definition one time. SOQs are not, and so I know that they'll be more cautious about adding to the SOQs just because those are not a one-time, and of course you can always change them back, but that's not been the experience or the history. And so I know that they are, from their public comments, they appear to be cautious about ongoing expenses based on an assumption about revenue streams that they're not sure what they will be. Thanks.
Alrighty. And the other one I wanted to talk about is,
I want to hitchhike on what Rob just said, because it is important. We are seeing a significant part of the influx of money that is unanticipated. It comes from $5 trillion of six federal enactments regarding COVID. And so both in direct aid to states and localities, as well as indirect, which ends up with citizens or businesses, all of those things it's like drinking an energy drink in the fiscal system, if you want to put a picture to it. And that's what we have. And I think there's an anticipation. At some point, the effects of that energy drink are going to diminish, and we need to be prepared for that, as all of us.
Another one big thing I want to bring up was, I said school bus driver shortage, but not only that, but school bus drivers and teacher shortages. I mean, I know y'all are aware, but we still have open teaching positions in the county as we're sitting here. And, school bus driving, I don't know if there's any way y'all can do things to help us there, but I heard every county talking about this. When I'm hearing Fairfax talking about it, and they looked at me when I got up to leave the board of directors meeting and said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm sorry, but I got to go drive the bus." So anything y'all can do to help us there would be greatly appreciated.
So the shortage is based on the fact that they're not paid enough, or people are just not coming to drive because of the responsibility and double runs, or is it because of salary?
Well, the double runs are because we don't have enough people.
And other people get bonuses and so forth. So what did you find out the trend across the state of what is happening?
All of the above. Mm-hmm. All of the above. You're looking at a job that's not a full-time job. So a lot of times some people don't add benefits. Most counties do add benefits to it, but it's just a lack of the amount of pay. And, there's only so much juice we're going to get out of the orange.
So how do we want the legislators to help us with that? Which commission helps with that? Where does that go to?
I'm sure that would go back to appropriations with the Education Committee or the education funding. But those are just some of the things that I would hopefully y'all can help us with down there, is dealing with those unfunded mandates, which are, we get only a certain number, we would have to expand the number of SLQ positions. I guess that's the best thing that I'm asking for, is for y'all to go work to expand those, because right now the SLQ positions only cover about a third of the positions. Support positions, and a lot. There's some teachers, Ms. Gillen. Yeah. Ms. Gillen can answer that one better than I can.
our issue is the support cap that was instituted during the recession has never gone away. It's just continued, and we would love for the General Assembly to look at that support cap again.
I mean, how many do they allot us, Ms. Gillen, for Central Elementary? Is it like two?
You really put me on the spot now, Mr. Sherry. I appreciate it. I have a lot of numbers in my head, but I think the biggest issue is, it just uses that flat ratio of teachers, but hardly any. We have about 70 instructional assistants. About three are in the SOQ fund.
I think it's literally one per building.
It's ridiculous, that disparity there. And we use those instructional assistants to assist us with unfinished learning and their reading supports and help us in those ways. But a lot of that falls back on the locality. And I know I'm not saying anything that you guys don't hear every year when we have this conversation.
Well, I think part of the challenge is that it really spreads when you're talking about a locality across all of the staff. And so while as Mr. Sherrod said, we can be grateful that you're helping with part of the raise. The impact of it is that if we get a raise for a group of people, say part of the schools, then we also have to apply that raise to the rest of the teachers in the schools.
Or other employees.
In fairness, and then of course that translates back and forth to the actual staff members of the administration and the rest of the employees in the county. So. That generosity translates into us typically having to raise taxes to meet those salary needs because 80% of our budget is salaries. You know, we recently had to increase pay for the sheriff's office to be competitive, which we're grateful to do. But by the same token, we're not for having extra COVID funds. That could have easily translated to maybe a penny or two on the tax rate. And so that's challenging. We're seeing the same thing with attracting bus drivers. It's just, it's an ongoing component of the job of county administrators to try to keep up with wage increases and demands, staffing increases and demands, and then having to do that in conjunction with, in essence, yes, state gives us some money, but it's not enough to print, right? And it's certainly not enough when it's a little bit, I don't want to say disingenuous, but it's a little bit of a shell game in the sense that, you know, we don't get any of the credit because we have to tax the taxpayer. There's really not a lot of room for us to cut services in any other areas. So that's I think you hear that all the time. You hear that all the time, and we know that you have an extra surplus budget. We understand the fact that this is one-time expenses, but at a certain point in time, especially when the new governor's talking about saying reducing taxes, 2.5% of the grocery tax, where's that money going to come back from? Are you going to reduce that tax and then take credit for reducing the tax and pass that right back to the localities who have to increase the tax? Is that the right thing to do? Is that fair? I don't think so. And I think that's a real frustration among all supervisors in general. And of course, I'm not taking that as a personal level, but I'm just saying this is a real ongoing game. I mean, I'm in this now 8 years. Mrs. Booker's probably been in 12 years. I think Mr. Weaver could probably say that this has been going on for a long time.
Oh, Doggy Bell.
So, we it feels like, oops, we're probably past the point. I was going to ask in terms of the school bus drivers. I think, I don't recall Ms. Levana, but I vaguely recall that it was that we had tried to expand the pool of available bus drivers by making it easier to rehire retired ones. I didn't know if that had any impact.
Ms. Gillum is shaking her head, yes. I know that we had one retired one come back.
We have a couple that have come back. And we did recently apply for the governor, the grant that the governor's office put out for a compensation bonus. So we're hoping that will be favorable. But, you know, one of the things that gets floated out there is doing sign-on bonuses. But I feel like that's just kind of smacks in the face of people that have been loyal to you and have been in the position for a number of years to sign up to give a sign-on bonus to somebody because they come in new. It also leads to people switching counties, going from one place to another so they can get a sign-on bonus.
And you end up in bidding wars.
Yeah, and I think our biggest message is as much flexibility as we can get in funding is the better for us because we can determine what our local needs are. And we're starting to see that in some of the proposed changes that came from the state board in terms of SOQ. There was some flexibility in terms of support positions for social emotional learning that weren't tied to specific positions, and that gives us a lot more flexibility. Particularly, we have a school psych position that we've had open for almost 2 years that we've not been able to fill. So the state can tell us that we need to have a certain number of school psychologists, but we can't find them. So those kinds of limits make it very difficult for us. So as much flexibility in funding that we can get, the better.
And the last thing to talk about flexibility, and this was something that Mr. Sheridan had also addressed under his issues. I mean, with the comp board, I mean, if you go back to the sheriff's office bonuses, if there's a way for that flexibility of funding, I mean, if the county didn't have to give $3,000 to every state-supported sheriff's office employee, you know, maybe it's that we could have provided $1,500 to all the sheriff's office employees and then not have to go and dip into the general fund. Again, you know, providing the localities a little more flexibility with comp board funding would be a huge benefit as we go through and budget and especially when these things come along at kind of the last minute too. I mean, again, we're appreciative, but it definitely puts us in a little bit of a bind sometimes because then we're left pulling general fund dollars at the last minute to make some of this stuff happen.
I guess it was a year ago, put in a resolution to request JLARC, our study commission, to look at compensation board funding for the three the sheriff's clerks and Commonwealth's attorneys seem to be under unique pressures in recent years. And if you're saying the disparity between comp board funding for deputies is 20, and they're
37 of
37 here.
Yes, sir.
It's a signal of the fact that the compensation board and it's the funding that we provide for them has not kept pace with the reality on the ground.
And Major Wells, you'll be able to answer this one. We probably have less employees than some of the counties around us.
We're one of the smallest sheriff's office. If you look at Goochland, which just, you know, butts up to us, is actually a smaller population. I believe they're at 50-something odd sworn individuals. And Goochland and Louisa's.
But they probably only have about 18 or 19, because it goes by population.
Yeah, correct? The comp board funding.
The comp board funding goes by population, so. That's definitely something that y'all should probably be putting a study for.
Then one thing to consider on that, if you would, is the problem with tenure legislation and mental health. I'll get to that later, but that's a huge burden as well. It's going to get a lot bigger. I don't think the comp board is adjusted for that in the ratio.
And I'll tell you, and this is something, well, Mr. O'Brien just brought it up, in the Central Virginia area, emergency services. A lot of the counties around here have already gone to paid full-time people. We were one of the few holdouts. We have paid rescue, and we still are trying to do volunteers to get stuff done, but it's becoming more and more difficult. So that may be something on y'all's radar down the road that y'all are looking into to comp. I don't know if you call it comp board funding for that. But now, Delegate Bell, you had said something about y'all did the exemption for bus drivers. This was a suggestion I made at our meeting this weekend. I don't know if it's a possibility, but is there a way you could? I know that districts around the state are having trouble filling classroom positions, and this is more of a band-aid than it is a solution. But that exception that you could retire, but you got to sit out a year and then come back. Well, if you let me sit on a fishing bank with a fishing pole, or you let me ride around a golf cart for a year, it's going to be real difficult for me to get out of that golf cart and get off that fishing bank and come back to the classroom. I didn't know if there was a possibility where if you're retirement age, you could retire and then just continue doing it. The one thing I said down there this weekend was if you could retire at the cap that your retirement is at right there, if any other years that you work would not count towards your retirement. Does that make any sense at all?
Yes.
That's what happens now with the hard to staff. But that the issue is the sitting out a year.
As soon as I said that, you might know Billy Kiger from over in Rockingham. He goes, "You're exactly right, Mike. I've sat out for three," and he called me four times. I said, "You're not getting me out of my chair." So. I know if you can keep in the routine, it's a lot easier than if you sit out and have to try to come back. So.
I can add to that, sir. That would also be beneficial for law enforcement if there was some sort of way to opt out of BRS for state jobs, because you're looking at a lot of well-trained assets that, like, for, you know, under us, I can retire next year at age 50. I still got a little bit of life left in me to work, but I can't go work for any other state job. And who would be better to run like DCJS or be some of these representatives that you're looking for other than people who've been doing law enforcement for 25 years? But you can't because it's BRS and you'll mess up the retirement system. And the small towns have that same issue because they're not paying the salaries, but if you could opt out and still get, like, I need health insurance, and there's a lot of guys in my boat. I know in Fairfax and some other places that have, you know, city retirement, you can retire as long as an open spot, you can come back. You just don't double dip in retirement. You basically don't get this retirement, but you have health insurance. So something like that, I think, would greatly help with staffing concerns all across state levels. Like, I couldn't even go manage a liquor store once I retired. It's a state job.
But Fairfax has found a way to do
Fairfax it. Is on city retirement. They're not state retirement. They have a retirement system. So that if their guys come back, hey, as long as we have a current vacancy, which they always have current vacancies, you can continue to work and just don't get any more retirement. We'll still pay your health insurance.
That's what I'm saying about with teachers. You know, just cap my VRS where it is, but continue to teach. And I'm retired, but I just draw my regular salary. Counties would save money because you wouldn't have to pay all the extra benefits.
That's a huge pool of trained staff.
That's certainly something
worth... Tell me, Lee, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, no, I just was going to say that's certainly something we could look at because we're in a different time because of our unique circumstance. I don't know if we're post-pandemic, but intra-pandemic. That may well be something to consider.
I don't know the answer to the, excuse me.
Delegate Bell, you just unmuted yourself.
I need help. So many ways, as my Jordan would say. So someone is on VRS retirement, so they hit the retirement age, which I think for regular state employees can be as early as 54, but the sort of the full comes in at 59. Do I have the basic parameter right?
For plan one and two, yes.
Yeah, okay. And if that person, I remember when this did come up with the school bus discussion, but my recollection is that that person can go work at a private provider, and it doesn't affect VRS, but it's when they come back in under a state VRS covered position. Is that, do I have it right? Is that the
issue? Yes.
Yes. As long if they are exceeding 32 hours a week.
Exceeding. So yes. Full time.
Yes.
Okay. And so for those employees, so you're 60, you're getting your full VRS, you don't want to wait, that the state employers would be a significant disadvantage because they would receive their VRS plus the new wage at, I don't know, Food Line, but if they stayed in the state system, you would, is that right? It cuts off the VRS at that point, you're earning, but you're not getting VRS?
Okay. So particularly in a school situation where someone could retire from public school and go teach at private school and they would be able to work full time and receive full compensation.
Okay.
And on the law enforcement side, like City of Charlottesville has city retirement. It's not uncommon for City of Charlottesville officers to retire at age 50. They come out and work for like Albemarle County Sheriff's Office or our Sheriff's Office and, you know, basically do another 10 years of service. And, you know, they just get into the retirement system. It'd be nice if you do that on RNX to help with recruiting and retention alike. Or even for dispatchers, the same way, you know, because you have that trained pool. And like I know GCGS is looking for, I forget, account reps and staff. And who better to fill those positions than somebody that's doing law enforcement for 30 years who knows how things kind of work and don't work in the practical aspect, not the academic aspect.
I'd certainly be glad to look at that. If somebody could. One of you could send us just a brief summary of that, and we can take a look at what might be possible. I think we're in different circumstances, as I said, as to where we are.
I'll just tell you what I was told this weekend. They were like, well, that's VRS. We can't touch that. And I was like, well, who's in charge of VRS? And the legislators, they said the legislators can give guidance, I guess, is the best way.
That's it. Somewhat similar, I guess, in the sense that, you know, and what I hear everybody saying is that you have public servants, people that have dedicated their life to serving the public. They reach retirement age and, you know, they have the opportunity to do other things, but they can't stay inside the retirement system. And so you lose those public servants to the private sector when that ends up increasing essentially the demands on attracting people to public service, which is already difficult to do. You know, I put a similar kind of comment in here about for board of supervisors and school board members, people that are not on the VRS system, not that they necessarily get VRS, but they at least get credit for the public service so that if they do translate into a public service job that has VRS, that they would have the opportunity to count part of those years as part of their vesting into VRS. I think the state could be creative in finding ways to attract, whether through its tax deductions, whether it's through incentives, into the retirement system and retain employees that it sounds like they're a little bit handcuffed right now in terms of doing that. So
and again, you know, just in localities right now, workforce is a big issue, whether it's a sheriff's office, whether it's a finance department. If you go to a VACO website or any type of the local organization sites, there are a lot of people. I was just reading an article about the great what's it,
the Great Resignation.
With the Great Resignation, and people are just leaving the workforce. And if there's a way to retain those valuable employees without being hamstrung by what VRS does, that would be a big benefit to localities.
I think it would also help with social services, because there is a great staff shortage with social services across the state, and I think the VRS issue would definitely help with keeping those trained staff in the system.
So yeah, we can try and get some information together and send that your way.
Perfect.
Yep.
All right. Next up is Mr. O'Brien's comments about the redistricting, and we knew we were going to talk about that.
Again, you have said it yourselves that there's a lot of questions out there. Depends on the particular county as to where they stand in terms of redistricting, whether they had elections or did not have elections, how they're looking at the maps, whether they should be producing the maps. Again, at the VACO conference, we spoke to some of our colleagues. I did a survey with the TJPC, fellow county administrators that I have, county supervisors, as to what their plans were for redistricting. Some counties are trying to meet to the letter of the law and the Constitution, have this all wrapped up by the end of the year. Other counties are saying, well, we just don't know what to do, and we're going to wait. And again, depending on how you read the letter of the law, it could bring into question whether or not a member who has recently been elected in this last cycle and is then redistricted out is actually even able to sit for the term. That's not clear at all. There's no guidance on that. And certainly that would seem to disenfranchise the voters, which is very problematic. And again, there is no true sort of statement that says, if you go past this year, what's going to be the penalty, right? I mean, you know, where does the penalty lie? There is no penalty that's there. And certainly if there's a penalty, it should be on the state, you know, for its lack of being able to do its job, which I also understand is part of the federal responsibility that they didn't do their job. So clarity there, whether that's coming from the Attorney General, especially as we get into the last few weeks here in terms of the cycle and what is actually going to happen, in particular for members that were recently elected, to ensure that we're maintaining the election results is really important, so that we as supervisors can ensure that we're making the right decisions and informing the public as to where that stands. So that's a real problem for us right now. And then we have the question of, even after we do all this, say we redistrict our maps, we've got it all in place, say even the Attorney General ratifies the maps that we presented, and we've done it by the letter of the law from the Constitution standpoint, what happens when you guys haven't completed that, and then you give us new lines, and we have the issue with, you know, whether or not we fall inside the full state district lines from that standpoint. So yeah, any guidance that you give us there would certainly be very, very welcome.
Delegate Bell, you want to jump on this one?
Yeah, I can sort of describe where the state process is. I don't know if that answers what you're getting at, but it might provide some background, and we can maybe talk if there's a way to get you the information you need. So the state lines, the lines that designate what district Fluvin is in, are currently being drawn at the Supreme Court. There was a redistricting commission that was not able to come up with a map that passed, and so by the state statute, it went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court just today announced that two special masters had issued an order that gave them, I think it's 30 days from today, I would like to read it, but to draw the state map, and that would designate, they're different, but the House of Delegates maps, which would define with where the district currently is, you know, as we've talked about it, put a Lee's district is on the eastern half and my district is on the western half, but also the state senate and also the congressional districts. And so that's the 30 days we will find out where that is. And it could be that the districts are similar to what they are now. It could be something entirely different. You could see a district that does not include where Lee and I currently live. So it could be an entirely new approach. We just don't know. So that's sort of that's the state level. Now, I confess, we were all waiting for the census numbers to come down and those have finally come out. And then I know that the counties will be doing their own. You have the same constitutional issues that we have, differently applied, but many of the same constitutional issues, Voting Rights Act and the rest of it. I don't know your timetable, and maybe that's what you're getting at. Is there something we can this is, if you're saying it is a lack of clarity, that's not something that we can usually fix, but we can, as you say, there'll be an attorney general. There's one now, it will be on January 15th, of course.
Sure, well, the timetable seems to imply that we, and guidance from our county attorney, suggests that we need to have set out our redistricting before the end of the year, right?
Okay.
That, and that the challenge there is that it also reads and says that if a member is seated in their district at the time of the redistricting, then they serve out their term. If they're not seated in their district, then they don't serve out their term. They're done, right? But if you are newly elected come December 31st, right, you have not started your term. And if we've now redistricted that person,
I see.
Then that's a problem, right? So, let me just finish the thought real quickly, Mr.
Yeah, sure.
So the thought is, okay, fine, we can go ahead and complete this come January 1st. Could be January 1st at midnight, you know, or at 00 in the morning. We could do that, but you know, guidance from the county attorney, which is his job, is to make sure that he's telling us the most conservative path to take, suggests that we need to have this done. We just don't know what the consequences are, and we don't really even know whether or not that applies, that you would essentially void the election results if you redistricted somebody out.
Yeah, I would never presume to give legal advice. You've got somebody who studied it directly. Is this because of the census? Why has this not come up sometime in the last 400 years? Is it because we have the census delay?
To your point, I think the answer there is twofold. One is the census was delayed, and therefore, and depends on the cycle, the election cycle that the counties have, because we're off year. They were not drawn at that point in time. And so therefore, you essentially had people running for districts that were unknown, if you want to put it that way. And then on top of that, add the fact that the state has not been able to provide earlier guidance, so that we even still have the problem of trying to do that, nor have they provided guidance as to whether newly elected folks would in fact not be redistricted out and be able to serve their term. And I understand that this is, you know, it could be that all 100 of you are running next year as well too. So I know you don't have the answer necessarily. I'm just trying to express the frustration that we're feeling at a local level. And of course, because we're in the process of doing the public hearings for redistricting, the community is feeling that angst and uncertainty and lack of clarity as well too.
Yeah, and just to give you an example too, I mean, some of our surrounding neighbors, Albemarle County, Louisa County, and Guthrum County, they are not going to redistrict by December 31st. You know, the Constitution says you must redistrict by December 31st, but there are other localities that are taking the stance that because the state maps haven't been issued yet, how can you actually draw the districts because the state maps haven't been issued? And so it puts localities on kind of a differing opinion, because you know, you're relying on your county attorney's guidance, and some county attorneys are saying, well, yes, the Constitution of Virginia says December 31, you must. But again, if we do, and then we get the new state district maps, those can change how we've gone into our actual redistricting on the local level.
So it's a big mess. So it would certainly be nice if the Attorney General said, hey, don't worry, guys, you've got until next year, whatever, February 2nd, to figure this all out. You know, we realize this is a mess, and let's get on with life. Or you know, 60 days after the state draws its lines, certainly that would be best. And again, as I said, there is no quote-unquote penalty punishment that's listed out in the Constitution. It just says you must. But as our own county attorney said, he said, when we discussed the fact of postponing this, he said, you do that against my advice, right?
So this would presumably be a statewide problem. Mm-hmm. No one tried to go to court, get some kind of declaratory, I don't do this kind of law, but in some way get some kind of ruling, because even the Attorney General's opinion would not be binding. I mean, if somebody wanted to pursue this in some manner, file suit.
Yeah, the research that I've done so far on this hasn't really yielded anything with regard to any particular lawsuits or any particular direction. I mean, there's actually surprisingly little information that can be gathered. There was one website that had a long list, a history of different redistricting portions, but it's almost like a single page that goes on. So it was really one of the better ones that you could find outside of, you know, Ballotpedia, Wikipedia, those kinds of things.
And the one big issue that we could have financially is if we have multiple districts that are cut by a line because of the state redistricting, we now have to pay for precincts in each side of that line. Mm-hmm. So, trust me, we had a Mr. Dahl and I had a conversation, Mr. Harris was getting us in line on it, but we could end up having to pay for 10 precincts.
Yeah, right now it says you know, districts can be, you know, split, but precincts cannot. So, you know, if the state lines are drawn after we redistrict, we could have a lot of different local expense on having to have additional precincts, which is an issue.
I would hope what you're describing is inevitable when two people are drawing maps and they're not drawing them in the same room. Traditionally, is prior to this decade, at some point there was a reconciliation bill that moved the lines a little bit to make sure the lines were consistent to avoid what you're describing. This cycle has not worked that way, and so I would hope, I think what you're describing is at least at some level unavoidable. There will be times that the state uses the old lines and the counties decide to move the precinct lines in some way. And I think that I would hope that we could, as over the course of the next decade, whoever's in the General Assembly, and hopefully the counties could find a way, just, I mean, because always, as you know, you actually have in Flavanna, as I recall, 18 pre-deed voters. And Creedies doesn't represent Flavanna, or so he thinks, but they discovered as GPS became more accurate than the population blocks that were used, they were actually entering which precinct. They actually have a handful of paper ballots that you use to vote in the Senate 20, whatever that is, 25th, I think. So again, being able to reconcile after would be the obvious way to do it.
And, and to just compound that a little bit too, you know, as Flavanna is currently in the discussions, we currently have 5 local districts. And so if the board, you know, again, the only time to change your district lines locally is during the census. So if we go from 5 to 6 or to 7 districts, it just kind of compounds and adds a whole different dynamic to this whole issue of not having state maps drawn at this point. We've reached out to VACO staff, legislative liaisons that they have, reached out to the statewide Department of Elections to get any clarity and guidance, and it's crickets.
It is. And Mr. Blunt, I know he's yeah. talked to some folks. If he wants to chime in on the conversation, so certainly would welcome anybody.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, the history of why the current cross-cut lines is that when they were drawn last time, they presumed 6 precincts, and 2 of them went into, 4 went into the 58th, and 2 of them went into, I forget Lee's number,
65.
Lee, but, and then the county decided to go to 5 districts, and so that's why the precinct lines right now, it's not, I mean, you could, you know, draw it, I mean, a third grader could show the geometry that when you go from 6 to 5, it changes the shape of things, but again, I think that you don't need legal advice. It would seem to me that up in Fairfax, one of these really, Virginia Beach, Chesterfield, one of the really big counties, somebody should try to find a way to get a definitive answer. You're going to leave a lot of the smaller counties that may not have the resources for that kind of legal work.
Yeah.
Trying to do the best you can under the advice of counsel as best they can, but one of you is making a mistake, and whichever side is making a mistake, at least in theory, there could be some form of legal redress.
It would seem that maybe either, is it something that an exec, you know, that an executive order could be passed by the governor saying, you know, counties and localities will be held harmless if they do not, or counties will be held harmless if they do not redistrict in the current year?
If it's a part of the statute, this is not my kind of law, but yeah. If the law says something and it's unclear, then you can act, but obviously a court is capable of coming in and saying that that's not the statute, you know, how the statute applied. I don't know if there's some legal avenue to try to get some kind of determination prior to, you know, stepping on it and making a mistake. It just, if half the counties are going one way and half are going the other way, somewhere, somehow, somebody is going to feel aggrieved and want to pursue a legal remedy, I would think.
Yeah.
I'm sharing your unease, I guess.
I don't disagree. The thought being is that it seems to me that all this lies on the state, not on the localities to figure that out. Why would you have 50 counties or 100 counties going out and trying to figure this out, getting different legal advice from different folks, when we really just need the clarity? I'll leave it at that.
I described it the other night as the cart before the horse. It's almost like we need y'all's lines, and then we can make ours and figure it out from there. All right, well, thank you. Let's move forward. I think we spoke about a little bit of everything, Coach, Mr. O'Brien. Ms. Treadway.
So what I have submitted actually is very specific as far as changing the code relating to the collection of probate tax. Currently, as far as probate goes, probate tax on real estate is only collected when a will is probated or if there's a grant of administration, meaning an administrator and an intestate estate, no will, is appointed. So individuals who don't need to qualify on an estate, such as, you know, they have a bank account that's owned jointly with an individual, but they own $1.2 million worth of real estate here in Fluvanna County, they can come in and record a list of heirs real estate affidavit and pay a $25 fee, which is considered the probate tax, and not have to pay probate tax on the $1.2 million of real estate. Whereas if I have the same situation, but I have a bank account that I have, or a situation where I have to qualify, someone has to qualify for some measly retirement fund or, you know, something like that, and I own $1.2 million, my family has to pay probate tax on the $1.2 million of real estate because they have to qualify for whatever reason. And I just find that to be a huge discrepancy and a huge loss of revenue. If you're looking at every county and city in the state that is losing probate tax on probates or real estate that is not having to be paid probate tax on, that is a lot of revenue. You know, Fluvanna County, we're small. I mean, our probate tax is not exorbitant, but it is something. And so it's a loss to the state and a loss to the county. The $25 fee, which is, like I said, considered the probate tax on those forms, is a state fee. So the state gets the $25. We don't have an ordinance here in Fluvanna that allows us to collect the $25 for locals. So not only do we get nothing when someone records these probate, these list of heirs real estate affidavits. And I just feel like, you know, to be honest, I'll do whatever the code says, which is currently that's what we do, but I just feel like it's a huge, it's just not consistent across estates. And, you know, for lack of a better way to put it, very unfair to certain families. I mean, you know, if you happen to plan, do estate planning, and you draw up a will and you have this and you have to record it, then you're getting stuck. But if you, you know, for whatever reason, don't have a will, or you've planned it, I don't have to pay probate tax, I'm not going to have a will and I'm going to put all my accounts jointly. I mean, the $1.2 million situation did just happen recently. I mean, multiple pieces of property, and no probate tax, $25. That's all we got.
Wow.
And, you know, I find that to be a problem. So I just wanted to bring it, because I don't know that a lot of people know that. I mean, amongst the clerks, we talk about that at meetings, and I've actually submitted this to our legislative committee through the Clerks Association as a possible, you know, something for us to pursue. But, you know, we have a long list of things that, you know, we try to pursue. So I don't know how high up on the list this is. But I just wanted to bring it to your attention that this is an issue out there, and it is revenue that the state is just simply giving up, as well as localities. If we could get those laws changed to where probate taxes, attaches to all estates when someone passes, if they have real estate. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting too, because real estate is usually one of the largest holdings that people have.
Mm-hmm.
and the guidance normally would suggest that you get a will, but now you're paying the taxes. But if you're under a certain level, you're not going to be paying federal estate taxes anywhere, or local estate taxes either.
And don't get me wrong, there are estate planning techniques that can still get individuals from having to pay that. Now they have transfer on death deeds that automatically transfer the property when someone dies, like a beneficiary of a life insurance policy. There's those types of things that would still get people around having to pay probate tax, but you know, it takes an attorney to draft those up, and you know, we don't see a whole lot of those, but you know, across the board, pretty much, I just don't think it's right. I find it to be a discrepancy in the code.
So. I'd have to defer to my attorney.
Okay,
I'll
already opining about all sorts of things I don't know much about. If you see me typing, I'm typing to our legislative services about that last issue. I don't have any. This is the first I've heard of this.
We can burn your will up.
That's fine. I just wanted to bring it up.
Okay. All right. Next is Dr. Gretz. Well, we kind of talked about standards of quality support caps earlier.
The one other thing I would say that's not listed here is I think sometimes there are representatives in the General Assembly that come up with legislation law that really hasn't, that has an impact on education, but really hasn't been vetted with educators. And I just want to offer
that just educators.
Well, one of the biggest things that came up that really impacted us this past year was instituting growth assessments. And then having the state develop a growth assessment, when in reality, a lot of school divisions already had growth assessments, and we weren't allowed to use the ones we already had. We had to use the new ones, and then they're not valid. I just want to offer, if that kind of thing is coming up and you're not sure, we're more than happy to help talk you through what is being proposed, because it's obvious to us that some of that really isn't taking into account the perspectives that might be there.
Are you talking about teachers in this institute?
No, it's students. They instituted a growth assessment for all students that the state had to develop, and the state was not prepared to develop it, and it's not a valid measure, in my opinion, for whatever that's worth. Apparently not much, but that kind of thing seems to happen from time to time, so I just want to... I would encourage you to reach out, and we'd be happy to give our perspective on it. And I'm sure other educators would as well, because all of us at the end of the day, we're sitting around kind of going, where did this come from? Nobody's ever heard of this. And I'm sure it was very well-meaning and very well-intentioned. It just, there's definitely different perspectives.
The ESSER funds, Ms. Gillen.
Yeah. This doesn't necessarily impact us, but as much flexibility as we can have on the deadlines for ESSER funds, it would very much be appreciated. Particularly some of the funds that are tied to capital projects. If people didn't already have capital projects in the works, it's very difficult to get things through and approved in time to expend those funds by the deadlines. And again, this is not something that we see impacting us, but we know our colleagues around the state are having this issue.
I know when we had the first of the pandemic enactments from Washington, I got that very frequently, people not, particularly schools, not having the time to do it and expend it within the time frame. So there was that extension. I know there has been a push since then. I've spoken to our congressional representatives about that, and I think they've become cognizant of that.
Well, and particularly now, because the thing I hear in every meeting is we have supply chain issues, and so I hear that constantly.
Supply chain issues, workforce issues.
Yes. And then everybody has the funding, and so the larger vendors are having difficulty, and so what are they going to do? Choose the larger projects that they get the biggest bang for the buck.
And Dr. Gretz said specifically, I think theirs are like ours. Our ARPA funds have to be done by the end of the year 24.
You have to be obligated.
That's the same with the ESSER funds, and he wanted to go from 24 to 26. 24 is not listed on here.
Well, and I mean, I appreciate the funding that we've gotten, but I cannot tell you how many more grants we need right now that all have different rules. And we haven't added any staff in our office, so we're all spread there.
All righty. Major Wells.
That was an excellent segue, because I think we're in the same boat as far as legislation that's been passed that perhaps very well intentioned, obviously was not consulted with the people who boots on the ground. We're in the exact same boat for multiple things. Biggest thing that I want to discuss was just our totally shattered emergency medical health system for mental patients we have. The Marcus Alert bill, again, I think is probably very well intentioned. I know I've spoke to Mr. Bell about some of this in the past. For those that are doing the pilot programs, it has been described as trying to fly a plane while you're building it. It simply doesn't work. There's like a lot of, again, it's an unfunded mandate, a lot of good intentions, but we have deadlines that we have to meet for regulations and training, except for Department of Behavioral Sciences and DCHS has yet to give us those guidelines, policies, and protocols. So I'm not quite sure how we're gonna have stuff in place by July when we don't know what we're supposed to have trained for. And just the staffing levels, I believe the Sheriff and Shenandoah just asked for 3 more deputies to try to meet what we think might be the program implementations. And besides that, it doesn't even address the biggest issue that all law enforcement, or at least sheriffs, are facing right now, is the temporary voluntary detention orders. Department of Behavioral Health has failed miserably. We actually had one on Wednesday where they refused to accept a patient under a temporary detention order, and that's a bed of last resort by law where they have to take the patient. Because the respondent was COVID positive, our deputy drove the nursing in crisis there, and they said, nope, turn us around. Which leaves us holding the bag because we don't know what we're supposed to do with that person. Because under statute, we can't release them until they're accepted, but when the agency refuses to accept them, you know, we don't have the option of saying, oh, you're COVID positive, I'm sorry about your mental health crisis, go sit by a tree. We can't do that. You know, we have to provide services for them. We end up driving this poor girl all the way back over to Fluvanna County from Western State and Stanton, where I finally called the Community Service Board, who's also failing drastically. Oh, you didn't get it? We got a diversion order to go back to Augusta Medical, where this girl was in the first place. That was issued at 4:00 after we left Western State at about 2:15. So there's just a monumental breakdown there that leaves us, you know, what do we do? We're trying to help these people. They haven't committed any crimes. You know, we're very limited in our options as far as detention. Because remember, when we're detaining somebody, that's a Fourth Amendment seizure. So we have a lot of civil issues we're dealing with that we simply don't have the answers for because the code on TDOs is so poorly written and we don't have any recourse. We're the ones stuck holding the bag. You know, there's some places the community service boards are getting TDOs for hospitals that they know will not accept them because there's nothing in the code section that says the magistrates have to ask if the hospital will accept that person. There's only 3 questions. Almost answer those 3 questions right, the magistrate will issue that TDO. One of those questions isn't, have you talked to Western State? Will they take this person? So they're basically what the community service board worker told me on Wednesday was, oh, it was a safety net TDO, which is something that doesn't exist by statute. So they're trying to game the system, but we end up as law enforcement get stuck with it. And realistically, how bad is it for somebody in crisis to get put in the back of a patrol car and driven literally all over the state back and forth? We've had one where we had to take them down to Norfolk. They had a medical emergency, so we're stuck in now an ER in Norfolk trying to figure out what we're supposed to do with these patients. And just the coding is terrible. Behavioral science is not playing by the rules, and it leaves everybody in need and just hanging. This little girl was crying. She's like, I'm just trying to get help. No one wants it. You know, we're trying to do what we can do, but we're not mental health professionals. And then we can't even fix what we have in place now, so I don't see how this Marcus Alert is going to. We need to hit a pause button. There's certain timelines in that bill for the Marcus Alert. We have to have certain mandates met, but we need to hit the pause, at least by legislative. Hopefully, since there's a change in the guard in Richmond, y'all can at least maybe, you know, there's been 5 groups that have done a beta test on it. Let's see the issues, because we had a VACOR meeting, and those folks were like, we're trying to comply with what we think might be gonna, the regulations are, but they're not passed yet. So they're just wasting tons of resources, and it's just not helping the problem. There's a problem there that needs help. We need a logical, well-thought solution where all the players had some input, not just some academics who don't know how it works or boots on the ground. And part of the Marcus Alert is this 988 system. Already in our dispatch center, we just have to go to EMD by another unfunded state mandate, which is emergency medical dispatch.
So we just had to train all our staff and do contracts for this training. So now we're gonna, have to work in the Marcus Alert protocols to figure out how that's gonna filter. But they don't, that doesn't talk to EMD. Both of these are unfunded, by the way. So now we're figuring out that's gonna work. But of course, they haven't actually established the 988 protocols yet. So the whole thing is a colossal train wreck. I'm not trying to be overly dramatic, but ultimately it's got people in need that are just left hanging in the wind. And I think there's these relatively simple legislative solutions, and then there's a lot more complicated ones that take money. A few places have used these regional day centers as kind of interim places. They used to have one in Charlottesville, and it kind of went away, I guess, when funding went away, when they closed all the state hospitals years ago. But a few places that I've talked to that have those day drop-off centers, that seems to be a good model. It might be something to look at down the road. I think hit the pause on Marcus, look at some of these day centers, rewrite the TDA legislation, at least so it's clear what we do if we have nowhere else to put this person. They tried to do that after the Crude Heats incident, but apparently the hospitals are just saying, nah, I'm not going to take them, sorry. So, and this is across the state. I've talked to people. I'm working with the BSA currently to try to get some legislative things brought forward. At the Sheriff's Conference, we talked about it. I mean, there's some agencies that sit with somebody for 5 days in an ER, and it takes up an ER bed, so I'm sure the hospitals are not going to respond to that either.
Well, I can tell you that on the floor of the House, when some of these issues were raised on the floor, it was actually Delegate Bell and then Delegate Villares, now soon to be Attorney General Villares, who pointed out some of the very practical problems. I'm not going to try and do it because Rob did it eloquently on the floor and pointed out a number of those practical questions. But
on the Marcus, it was. The concern was is that it said we will have a group get together and lay out the program, but it wasn't. And then we'll look at it and decide what happens. It went directly to the rollout, and these are the specific issue about how you should address someone who's mentally ill, hopefully with someone from a mental health background rather than law enforcement, is a big picture idea that I don't know anybody opposes. But the actual implementation where you don't have a dense population like Arlington is very hard. And I don't recall Lee voting for it. I know I didn't. And it wasn't that I didn't like the goal, but what you're describing is we had been staring at these implementation difficulties and thinking of pilot projects. We kind of jumped over those steps and just said, we don't know what it's going to be, but we're going to do it, and it's going to happen. And so I'm concerned about what you're describing. The TDO issue is not easy, but there's a direct, I'm looking at the chart. If there was a way to share it, I would share it with you. But the issue is that the TDOs themselves, the numbers have been relatively flat since 2015. And in the highest, I guess it was 2016, 2017, they've actually gone down since then. What has happened is the number accepted by the private hospitals has gone down. And I used to have this number in my head. It's like some significant, it's gone down from 22,000 to 16,000. I guess 22.2 to 16.6, so 22.2 to 1700. And the state hospital beds are supposed to be reserved for the sickest, neediest, most complicated cases, and instead they're having to pick up the slack. And until that changes, every year it got closer. They identified this about 4 years ago, and we kept finding ways to make it a little better. And gosh, private transport and transportation group, and we have different drop-off options. And the drop-off in the numbers being accepted by the private hospital so greatly exceeded the improvements that it obviously it overwhelmed it, and here we are. I think that just today I've been reviewing some options that will not leave everybody happy, but it might at least break the current long jam, which is that private hospitals don't have to take, the state hospital ultimately has to, but has a relatively modest number of very, beds that are being taken up by some of the neediest people in the whole system. But I would encourage you to continue to encourage the sheriff's offices, the sheriff's association, law enforcement to get their shoulder behind this, because we have been staring at this problem as it looms larger and larger until this year. And today, the obvious solution, which would be, and I told the hospital this, I said, we don't need you to take more, just take what you were taking 4 years ago. We wouldn't have any problem at all. None of what you're describing would be an issue if the private hospitals took simply what they took 4 years ago. Has not to date happened. So we will see if there's a way we can get that done.
Thanks, sir. even quickly, just like any kind of clarity to basically cover, if we have to sit with somebody for an extended period, that's fine, as long as we know we have solid legal footing. Because as it stands now, the code is very ambiguous, and if we have to use force on somebody and we have them unlawfully detained, that's not going to work out well for us or the county when that lawsuit comes. So even if we have to do extended detentions or transports, as long as it's clear where our authority lies in the, maintaining that detention of the person, I would say we don't want to detain them any longer than necessary because it's a civil infringement.
I would suggest that that is a relatively specific and easy thing to do. On the other hand, it would, I suspect, exacerbate still further the passing the buck that's happening where they go, well, deputy, he's under your supervision, he's under your authority, we refuse to accept him, I don't know where you're going to send him, but it's not my problem. We have heard circumstances, as you just described, where someone has passed around the musical chairs that is involving someone's life, but for 5 days they're passed from ER to place to place to place to place, and the deputies are being replaced by subsequent deputies and all the rest of it. You may need that, and if that's true, talk to that again. That would be a statewide issue. The Sheriff's Association, I would think, would be very involved with it. But the larger problem is having the place for them to go. And so long as the numbers continue to decline like they have been, it's hard to see a solution aside from the state building a whole bunch more hospital, state hospital beds. And that's never been the role of the state hospitals, and it also means longer, further transport. So instead of being at a nearby community hospital where the family can visit, you're being shipped across the state. Now, that's still better than what we have now. And if we have to, that is a route we can take. That seems like an imperfect solution to what is, I mean, a problem being caused by other issues.
And just, I'll give you the example, like the TDO that was issued on Wednesday, the community service worker even said, she really didn't need to be TDO'd, I just didn't know what to do with her, so we just got this TDO just in case. We may let her go before y'all transport, so just give it a while and we'll see what happens. That TDO should never have been issued. This girl should never have been committed in the first place. So if there's anything we can do on that end to tighten the requirements, I think if we can change the requirements, the manager has to ask and make sure the manager goes, do you have a bed for this person? Is this, you know, maybe some sort of stopgap. Don't issue the TDO unless it's absolutely necessary. Might alleviate some of that. I think there's a lot of concern about liability. So they're just, you know, well, let's get the TDO and let somebody else, you know, kick it down the road, let somebody else deal with it. But we have a lot of those where the, you know, or maybe an emergency custody order for 8 hours, you know, once they calm down, the alcohol usually gets out of their system as a common factor, then reevaluate, not just automatically jump to that TDO. And I don't know if there's an easy answer, but I'll keep working with the VSA and see if we can come up, get something to y'all since the numbers have changed a little bit. Maybe we can at least get a pause and reevaluate on some of this stuff. So thank you for your time.
I do think part of the issue is there's such limited mental health support in rural communities that situations get to a crisis point before they're addressed. I know that we have people that are actively looking for counselors and mental health support and they cannot find it. That's really the biggest issue.
Well, and that's part of the problem with Marcus too, is even this gets implemented, I don't know where they're going to find this army of counselors that are going to come out to Fluvanna County at 3 o'clock in the morning. I mean, we're told in rural environments that a 2 to 3 hour response time, that's not an emergency 3 hours from now. And I'm sure you see the same issue in the schools, and that's where the groups that have started these peer support day centers, they seem to have a lot of luck with those. There's a lot of volunteer support, and people can just go there on their own. Because right now, if we take them to go to UVA, they incur hospital expenses, because UVA wants to do a complete medical workup, and then there's insurance and medical issues there. Or if they go to one of these peer support or volunteer places, where it's not going to be a hospital admittance on top of just getting mental health. I mean, nobody likes to go to the ER and sit for 8 hours. They're not getting any services. They're just sitting in a room. They're not getting help. And the ones who really need it have been through this two or three times, and they know, well, I'm not going to bother. So either just don't call, or somebody waits until it reaches that point of violence to call instead of take them somewhere earlier. They could just go somewhere earlier. And that, I know that's a large funding issue, but I just want to put that out there for consideration.
I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, at Social Services, we had a similar issue. We had a youth in foster care who was having a mental health crisis. Initially, the magistrate did not issue an ECO. The magistrate said the department did not have custody. So that night, our staff spent the night in our office with the youth. The next day, we took the youth to see a magistrate again, was able to get the youth ECO'd. The youth went to UVA Hospital, was TDO'd. The sheriff's office was TDO'd to Commonwealth Center. The sheriff's office transported the youth to Commonwealth Center,
got there, they said, we have no beds, you're not allowed to come in the building. Sheriff's Office transported the youth back to UVA. At that point, the Sheriff's Office could not stay with the youth any longer. Our staff stayed with the youth for 2 days at UVA, again in an unsafe situation for our staff, before our staff found a hospital that would take the youth. So I agree that that really is a problem.
And that's the thing, if we don't have a lawful vessel to maintain custody of somebody, we cannot keep somebody in custody, not to mention we don't have jurisdiction in UVA unless we're executing a TDO. And if you look at the code section, it's ambiguous what the term execute means. Is it sign the paper? If you look at it in a search warrant context, it executes from start to finish. So we have to be starting or finishing something, have any authority at all in outside of Fumana County. So it's, there's a lot of moving parts, and it's all very, very much broken and rusty. And it puts everybody at risk. You know, we'd love to help out VSS, but if I don't have lawful process to detain a juvenile, I can't detain a juvenile.
And it's, of course, risk, and, you know, it's more harm to the person that needs it, and correct, it's an enormous cost to the county as well, too. Because we have to hire additional deputies to basically chauffeur and babysit folks, and we have to hire additional staff as well, too. And lack of psychiatrists and counselors, you know, helps that situation that could have maybe been handled early on and mitigated, you know, escalates.
Alrighty, so now we'll go down to the county staff's concerns with economic development.
Yeah, you know, these are just some things, you know, as Delegate Ware, as you spoke about before, about the Commonwealth surplus, you know, we were just at the Virginia Association of Counties conference this past week, and then they had some good economists talking about what that surplus may look like over the biennium. I know you said $8 billion, and there were even some low estimates of up to $10 billion over the biennium. I know there's a lot of discussion, and this is just really about support for the counties. You know, certainly from supporting workforce development, you know, that's a big thing. When you hear a lot of these businesses in Virginia and the Commonwealth, we want to continue to remain, you know, one of the better business states around. And, you know, a lot of the things that we're hearing, and it's just not Fluvanna, it's you know, statewide, is having, you know, the proper workforce and providing the training to kind of shift some of those employees to kind of remarket them in a new way. In addition to that, you know, we've got a great high school for CTE, career technical education, and, you know, providing some additional funding. You know, not everyone needs to go to college. We have a lot of students that, you know, go to a great high school, and we've got lots of employers that with the right training and the right support and the right funding, we can get them into very well-paying jobs coming right out of high school. So just as you all are looking at, you know, what the surplus looks like, you know, we certainly want to make sure that you're looking after, you know, supporting workforce, whether it's high school students coming into the workforce and or just the general workforce. And I just got two other things. One thing, you know, with the no excuse 45-day early voting, you know, certainly that has opened up the opportunities to provide more people to vote than just the 1 day a year. From just locally ourselves, you know, we didn't have, when that was implemented, we didn't have the space to accommodate that from a ADA standpoint or anything. So the county had to go ahead and lease a building elsewhere so we would have the proper facilities. Implementing the 45-day early voting probably cost us about $100,000 additional a year to do that. And without having the proper funding, again, that's just another unfunded mandate. And again, it's provided, you know, more opportunities for people to vote. But again, from the county standpoint, decisions and really need to be considered when how that affects the county. And then just kind of the last thing, kind of discussing the surplus, you know, I know there's a lot, some things discussed about, you know, from a lot of counties, we have a really old aging infrastructure of schools. You've got schools that are 40, 50, 60 years old and just in ill repair. I know there was some discussion about, you know, providing funding to localities to really kind of get some schools up to par. You know, one alternative to that too is, you know, if funding's not provided, again, counties will then have to go out and either raise the tax rate significantly to pay for that, or they have to take out debt. You know, one alternative is, in the past, there was some type of literary fund, so maybe some of this surplus could go to some extremely low interest rate financing for localities, or 0% interest financing for localities to make the improvements and to get our schools up to be a school that are worthy of our children to be in. So just certainly wanted to just kind of keep that on the mind of when the budget's moving forward and legislation's coming forward and funding's coming forward, certainly wanted to just kind of keep those things in mind.
Right, can I have one?
I do know that on the discussion about the surplus, one of the topics that was raised in that was replenishing the literary fund for that very purpose.
Okay.
Obviously, there are limits to that, but as many localities
sure.
as we have, but even doing something toward yeah. that to make it available and enhancing what could be available at a better rate for school construction is it's a huge problem.
Yep.
It's commonwealth-wide.
Yep.
I was going to also add, as the infrastructure money starts to come to the states, and I know a lot of it is dedicated towards water and sewer, and I don't know the details, so I may be redundant here, but certainly consideration that if projects that are already underway be considered for funding as well, too. You know, those are costs that we incurred and are still struggling to build, so certainly we would hope that the state would consider underway projects for water and sewer, not just new projects.
And I think we're almost pretty timely here, unless anyone else has comments.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, I'll leave.
Did anyone else have anything they wanted to add?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, this is David. Can I bring up one subject?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, just kind of playing off of Mr. Dahl's last comment with regard to school facilities. I know there has been some discussion in several different parts of the state about an initiative that I guess worked its way through the General Assembly on a couple of occasions several years ago, and that was to authorize various localities as what are called qualifying localities for purposes of having a voter referendum and initiating then a 1 cent, additional 1 cent sales tax to be used solely for school construction and renovation. So I know that there have been both Democrat and Republican sponsors of that legislation in the past. Would expect that perhaps we would see that again this year. Don't know if either one of the delegates would have any thoughts as to what the prospects of something like that might be for adding additional localities to that list. There's about 9 right now.
In terms of the prospects of adding them, I don't know what that would be. We will in the House particularly have a number of new members. It's hard to anticipate what the response would be. Anytime you make that sort of a change in the code, you're going to get that will bring a sharp debate, as you know, David. And it's hard to game what the likelihood of adding would be.
Thank you, Delaware.
Mr. Chairman?
I'm getting ready to ask if you had anything to say.
Just a couple quick things. Thank you. I wanted to specifically say thank you to Lee and Rob. They're their counterparts for continuing to support our career development funding that the Comp Board always comes to the General Assembly with, and that's specifically for career development for Constitutional Officer's Master's Program in the various, 5 different areas. We very much appreciate it. It's not 100% funded, but it was funded to a point that the list of Master Deputy, commissioners, Master, prosecutors, master deputies, insurance department. That list of people waiting for the additional certification money has been greatly narrowed. So thank you. And I know they'll be coming back to you again. So career development, when you hear it, we appreciate your support. Thank you for funding at the level that y'all been able to. Second thing I wanted to touch base on, because I know, again, the amount of additional revenue is probably fleeting in the Commonwealth, but every county municipality is dealing with another significant issue, and that is the tremendously increased value of personal property. Every person sitting in that room is driving a vehicle or has some type of truck or something, and the value has gone exponentially through the roof on all of that. We have, Extension General Assembly, or PPTRA funds, or car tax relief money, and that helps a great deal, but the shrinking nature of the amount of the percentage of funds that we have for our car tax relief or personal property tax relief act, PPTRA, has gone down. You know, it's kind of a high watermark. I think each of y'all were there, probably, I suspect, when we hit the high watermark. And we were about 60% of personal property tax revenue came to us by way of the state for PPTRA. That figure now, because of the value of all their used cars, new ones too, of course, has gone up so much that we're down to about 30% here in Smooth Island. I don't need to go over history of it, I know y'all know it well. But should there be any opportunity for those caps that were placed on us, I don't specifically know the year, I think it's about 2008, to be increased, Smooth Island happens to be 1.99 million, each county got capped, we could use some help there. Because again, Smooth Island, like most of our rural, even our municipal areas, personal property, real estate are up to 800 pound gorillas in the room for revenue. So it's gotten to the point that, and I suspect it's the same in any town that is in the county, that many of our citizens are now paying more for their personal property taxes than they are necessarily for their real estate taxes. It's really inverted because, frankly, nothing that any of us have done, but NADA, J.D. Powers, all of the valuation companies have raised the value of used vehicles and new ones, of course, too, through the roof. Went up about 25% across the board last year. We've been briefed it's going to go up another 20 to 25% this year. So again, how the state could help would be, and I know you don't want to pull the curtain back on PPTRA, I doubt, to consider increasing those cap amounts to localities, but Lord, it would help every municipality or every county in the Commonwealth. And at the same time, because I just simply got there here with four sitting board members and a newly elected one right behind you, please consider lowering that personal property tax rate. I'm the person that hears it as well as you do. If we have our rates stay the same, there will be a 50% increase in personal property taxes for our citizens over the last 2 years, counting this coming year. So I would hope that we'd be able to do something locally. PPTRA would help us just as any increase at all. Lastly, I had a chance to work with Mickey Wells and his folks, and I'll just be brief. Please support our governor-elect in maintaining qualified immunity any way you can do it. That is a standard that people I'm lucky enough to work with, even just as a reserve deputy, and their career guys, we have to have if you want to maintain the level of professionalism that we have. I hear it every time I'm there, and we appreciate y'all's support for it. Protect those guys. I think that's the toughest job, and ladies, the tough job, and qualified immunity gives them insurance that they need. Thank you. That's all, Mike.
Mel, there's one thing I can say categorically. Qualified immunity is very safe this year.
I only hope so. And I hope for many years to come.
I would agree.
All righty. Is there anyone else that wanted to add anything? Did you want to say anything at the end, Delegate Ware?
No, just I guess the only thing I would say is it's a great chance to catch up and hear firsthand some of the specific issues that you all are facing. And this is, I appreciate all of you that have participated to make this possible and have this kind of a forum, because we do get a chance to hear directly, and some of which are very familiar, they're regular, but some that are new with changes, particularly significant changes in the last 2 years. We will be in touch, and I certainly ask you all to maintain that connection with us as well.
Delegate Bell?
Appreciate everybody who spoke. I can see itty-bitty people behind you in the camera, which I assume are all the people that do the real work, all the staff. I appreciate their time as well. And so thank you, and God bless, and I hope you have a nice Thanksgiving.
And I would be remiss if I did not ask our newly elected supervisor, Mr. Fairchild, do you have anything you wanted to add or say?
No, the biggest thing I wanted to hear, being here, I wanted to get educated on everything, but the biggest thing, of course, redistricting is very notable in my life right now. And I also wonder if it was postponed, say for a month, let's say the governor did do an executive order, so I guess elected people would not take office until January 1, maybe until it was postponed, because you wouldn't have the districts necessarily for them to fill. I don't know.
My assumption on that was that come January 1st, you're seated.
What?
Because you're in the existing district that hasn't changed.
Yeah.
So you're seated.
That's what our lawyer told us, is that if nothing is done until after January 1, you would serve as the Cunningham District, whether you lived in the Cunningham District or not, supervisor for 4 years.
Okay. And I was also wondering, regarding the governor's mandate, if that was to happen, is the governor's mandate in place once that governor is gone? In other words, once he's out December
31st. He starts January 1st, too.
The new governor?
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying, is the mandate.
The 15th.
Oh, whatever, January.
Hold on. Yeah, it's not until January 15th. So once January 1 comes here.
Correct.
It's from what our attorney told us. Once January 1st, and he even stated the other night, to even make it more confusing, that it's not ratified until the Attorney General ratifies it, and the Attorney General probably won't ratify it until February the 1st, whatever we redistrict.
It occurred to me that we could put it to the Attorney General December 31st at 10 p.m. at night.
Or at 11:59.
But that's an ambiguity that we don't know. So that's just.
But any guidance that you guys, if y'all could get it, hear anything, and just help us out over the next 2 weeks. We're supposed to sit down on December the 15th, and make this decision. It's what we've got on our calendar. Now, we could choose to defer it as a group and just say, okay, we'll live with the consequences. But as you can see, we're just kind of lost. Y'all have the Supreme Court to do it for y'all. We don't have that one. We can't just say, okay, y'all guys go draw up our lines for us.
Rob, can you hear me?
I can hear you, but I've got a 4 o'clock hard stop. I was just waiting for a chance to say I appreciate all your time. I'm happy to follow up. I just can't do it right now.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming out today, guys, and joining us. We do appreciate it.
You bet.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just thank David Blunt for helping us out. He just popped off for kind of getting this together. Thank you, David, for kind of assisting and kind of getting everyone together again. And then thanks to the staff, too, for Ms. Harris and Ms. Solis for kind of putting this together, and other staff for kind of getting this all set up. And again, Delegate Ware, thank you for being out here today.
And thank y'all for the wonderful snacks, because some people didn't show up. They won't be able to partake in the snacks.
That's right.
Not that I'd ever talk trash to my brother. All righty. Yeah. Now, we've got to go ahead and adjourn our meeting, so.
Chair, I move that we adjourn the meeting.
Motion made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Mrs. Booker. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 4-0 with one absent. Thank y'all so much, folks.